This training track entitled Leading and Raising Men. Session 1, Who is Adam Really and Why It Matters? By Joel Virgo and Matt Hosier, was recorded at the New Frontiers Together in a Mission Conference 2009 in Brighton.
Thank you. Society is risk-averse, of people who are professional rather than bold, anxious to know. Manliness again says, manliness says war, like the rest of my heroes, rational control wants peace, distanceless and preferred role models to heroes. And certainly now in the West, certainly in the UK, we live in a society which is risk averse and doesn't like the kind of command and control confidence of manliness. And prefer something which is much more plastic, much more safe, much more containable, much more boxed in. But sometimes manliness still breaks through. And a great example of that was with the lifeboat in Somalia. There were 10 lifeboatmen who in 1981 went out to rescue a ship and they all drowned. And in the sampling of the story, you'll over describe it like this. In the morning after the tragedy, volunteers stepped forward to fill the empty places. Just as strong as a sense of belief, perhaps even stronger, was pride in what the lost men stood for. Newton called the new students forward as irresistibly as a child. Neil Brockman, who was the son of one of the many drowned, was one of them, and he today was a top student in the lifeboat. His own son is keen to join him, even to face his dad as the time comes. Brockman understands the need. Now that's an example of manliness. This is what men do. This is how manliness breaks through. Men understand the need, they step forward in the face of danger. They don't consider filling in the risk assessment and not doing it if it looks too dangerous. They're prepared to command, they're prepared to confront, they're prepared to act confidently, they're prepared to step up and cross the line. And my dad has drowned rescuing somebody else, is trying to, I'm going to step up and take his place, and one day I expect my son to do the same. Now the challenge becomes, how do we really define manliness? How do we tie this down? How can we define what it means to be a man? And I want this morning to try and work towards some characteristics of manliness. And talking about this, as Joel's already alluded to, is fraught with dangers because of how sensitive we are now in our culture, to not causing offence and wanting to encourage and recognise women's interests. So we need to try and get towards some kind of definition, some kind of characteristic of manliness. And the thing is, we all know it when we see it. When we see somebody who's manly, we recognise it. It's just innate, but it's more difficult to define, isn't it? I was thinking to Perry, who is the most manly man that I know? If you think about a particular individual, it might help to give some definition to what a man is. And I think probably perhaps for me, the most manly man I know is Scott Marks. Well, I guess he's really summing up in the earth this morning. Scott from Mozambique, Zimbabwe. And the thing about Scott that defines him as a man to me is that he is somebody who is bold and adventurous. He's taken his family, taken him from Zim, going to Mozambique. There is nothing, they're living in tents and snakes all around and just wild and establishing businesses and planting research. He's incredibly generous, he's incredibly good-humoured, he's positive, he leads, he encourages, he builds up, he is not timid, he's bold. His ability to connect with all kinds of people. So when he's been to my house, he connects with my kids in a way that nobody else has ever been able to do. He walks in the door and immediate connection with the kids. But not just because we can connect with anybody and make anybody feel valuable and encouraged and built up. Godly man, not overbearing, gracious. And so I think of what is a man, I think of something like Scott. It's a man who's a model of manhood. And we know it when we see it. And the problem is that we all have those issues with all of our models as men because all of us fail, none of us are perfect. And those who we would perhaps hold up as models do actually have their weaknesses. Scott, I'm sure, has his weaknesses. We haven't even spot one in him yet. But all of our role models and heroes have things about them that we might think, oh, I'm not so sure that's a good example. Coming down here, I think they always need a skip. They might just skip over that. Or maybe not. Wayne Grudem, I'm going to quote an example of something sort of about manliness. I go to the pub on a Saturday night with the girl with the rest in my house at the moment. I'm not sure that Wayne Grudem is the first person to quote with me. John Eldred, who has had a huge influence with Wild at Heart, a theology in that book. And his models of manhood all being about mind and God's title, no recognition of the place of the fall actually in the blessedness of man. But guys who keep us in the world, me, enough of you know me well enough to be offended by me and to be aware of my limitations as a man. So we all have our imperfections, but that mustn't stop us from working towards these characteristics of what defines a man. And we must be aware and focus towards stereotypes. And it all comes to stereotypes we can fall into. And for example, the stereotype that is often said, I've been defending my seminars where it said, women talk as much as men. Women talk as much as men. Now I've done some research on that, and that is not true. It's an urban myth. There is no evidence of that being the case. The number of studies that have been done on how much men talk and how much women talk are actually extremely limited, and it's very difficult to measure anyway. And there's much more difference within the sexes than between the sexes. So some men talk a lot, and some men talk a little. Some women talk a lot, and other women talk a little. Men and women tend to talk more or less in different circumstances. The men tend to talk a lot in the areas in which men talk. And women tend to talk a lot in social circles. So you get a group of men and women together, the women are more likely to be immediately talking because women are better empathizers. We'll come on to in a moment. But men talk just as much in their areas of interest. So we must be aware of stereotypes and not fall into a bind of urban myth. We also need to be aware of the danger of appealing to a mystical golden age of manhood, which I think we can experience. And those of you who are British, we can look back as near all the days to the time of the Victorian age, and men were men, and we conquered the world, and built railways, and built ships, and the mystical ages of manhood, which wasn't necessarily that good. Because I think often things about our age are better. I think generally fathers are more interested in connecting with their kids now than previous generations were. So there's some positive things about contemporary worlds compared with the past. There's also a danger of pursuing manliness over and above Christ-likeness. And I think this is a danger for us as believers, as we have an increasing emphasis upon being men. The whole John Eldridge thing that came in, but after quickly the whole influence of Mark Driscoll, that we can be in danger of pursuing manliness, and a particular model of manliness, which is an asthma with killing things manliness. We can pursue that model more than we can pursue Christ-likeness. And that's also dangerous. And we need to look at consider the cultural influences and the effects we take us, that the greatest philosopher, the greatest prophet of manliness, of this sort of manliness, is Nietzsche. He despised Christianity. Nietzsche, who said, nothing is true and everything is permitted. What it means to be a true man is to do exactly what you want. That is manliness. And that is the ultimate definition of manliness. Do what you want. Be strong, be in command, be in control. Do what you want. And so Nietzsche dismissed Christ and dismissed Christianity because he said Christianity is like a shriveling insect playing dead in the face of an enemy, cringing. And that Christ screams that the whole notion of submission, of sacrifice, of humility is cringing. It's not manliness. And if we pursue manliness at the expense of Christ-likeness, the danger is we have to become more disciples and neutral than we are of Christ. Because it becomes more about self-assertion than Christ's imitation. And we must be very aware of that. And the irony of what Nietzsche taught, which may be able to read, just may be much apart from philosophy students for us to read Nietzsche, but it fills it into our culture. The irony is actually what Nietzsche taught has led to a diminution of real manliness, because what Nietzsche taught is cultural drift to both the slacker and to the tyrant. And we see slackers and we see the tyrant all around us. The slacker who says, I will do what I want, which means I will do nothing. And who are you to tell me any different? I will lie on my bed and I will drink my beer and smack my goat and sleep with who I like and you can go to hell. That is Nietzsche's philosophy worked out in the slacker. If also worked out in his time. I will do what I like. And therefore, I will be as sexist and misogynist and slap my women around if I want to, because I am a man and that's what I can do. And that is what happens when manliness itself is the only goal driving self-right. Now let's think a little bit then about the differences. Are there differences between the sexes? And I guess for many of us, this is so familiar, and preparing this, I thought, can I really go over this again, because we've heard it so often, but it is such a hot issue. I'm just looking at that interview that John Butler from Christianity Magazine did with Terry, in the magazine that comes out free for us when we came in. There's one thing that John Butler is interested in, is these unpopulation in the ministry. That's all he cares about, isn't he? And that paper that got to do with him in previous incarnation, and that's all he ever wanted to talk to me about. What about the role of women? What about the role of women? So this is still a huge issue out there. For us in New San Francisco, if you think that it's done, it's definitely the biggest stuff, but it's a massive issue out there still. So we'll just kind of go over the headings quickly, and I've just taken them direct out of Reading for Evangelical Feminism and Biblical Truth, which is the best resource for this stuff. You've got to have that on yourself. Immensely helpful. So we'll just go through this quickly just to remind ourselves why we think this is biblically sound, biblically true, biblically important. Creation number one, men and women are equal in value and dignity. Genesis 1:27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And that right at the beginning of the story witnesses against male dominance and superiority. That men and women are completely equal before God, made in his image, precious to him. And so our starting point has got to be, men cannot be dominant, they cannot be tyrant, they cannot exercise wrongful superiority of equality before God, men and women made in the image of God. Galatians 2:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. What we're going to tell them to do is take that verse, completely out of context, and say, well, therefore, there's no gender distinction, after our sex distinction. If there are people who are ethnically Greek and people who are ethnically Jewish, there are still people who are physically slaves and physically free, there are still men and women, but there's no distinction value. The slaves and free, and the Greek and Jews, the man and women, have equal value before God. Question number two. Men and women have different roles in marriage as part of the created order. Now this is the key one. Is male headship freefall or postal? Are men to lead as a result of a fall, or were they to lead even if the fall hadn't happened? And those are the two of these things. And so can you pick the first one? It's Adam who is created first, the man is created first, and Adam has a special role in representing humanity. And that becomes very important when it comes to our Christology in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 15:22, for as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. It's in Adam and the man that we have died, just as in Christ the man will be made alive. Adam, it goes first, was the one who named Eve. That's hugely important, that the person who named has responsibility, has authority to do that. And the whole of the human race is named as man. And again, in getting rid of manliness and replacing it with masculinity, and getting rid of sex and replacing it with gender, and getting rid of spouse and replacing it with partner, we've also got rid of man and replaced it with humanity or personkind or some other gender neutral, strictly mentioned term. Galatians 5:2, male and female who created them, so gender classes. Male and female who created them and can bless them and name them man when they were created. Five, Adam had primary responsibility. The fall happened, Adam and Eve sinned. Eve was the first one to take a bite of a forbidden fruit, but it's Adam that God has a problem with. It's Yahweh who speaks to Adam as the one who bears the primary responsibility, not Eve. Next one, Eve was created to help Adam, not the other way. Genesis 2:18, Eve a helper fit for him. And then we into the whole area of conflict that came as a result of the fall, that God's curses, the curse comes upon the earth, and there's a pain that is brought to the particular areas of responsibility that Adam and Eve have. So the pain on Adam's area of responsibility is that he's to provide, and so the area of pain, conflict for him, is that the ground is made of Adam, and thistle and thorny and difficult to work. Eve's particular area of responsibility is child-rearing, and that's where the pain is going to come to her. And then there's also going to be pain in their relationship. But God says to Eve, your desire will be for your husband. And how that is interpreted is a very simple position. I can take a whole summer looking at that. But the best interpretation seems to be that God, Yahweh talking to Eve, your desire for your husband, that speaks about a desire for your church and authority. That there's relational pain there. That the ground is meant to be fruit easily, Eve is meant to have children easily, and Adam and Eve are meant to get on to it easily. Now the ground is hard, child-rearing is hard, and relationships are hard because Eve is always trying to usurp her husband's authority, and that's been tempted to the end. We then see the restoration, Colossians 3:18. Wives, submit to your husband as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. And Paul's instructions there, what is possible in Christian marriage, reverses the Genesis 3 test. That men and women, husband and wife, are now to live in the way that God had intended. This ease of relationship comes back, and the way that that comes back is by the man not being a tyrant, but by leading his wife as he should, and by the wife not being a usurper, but being one who gladly submits to her husband. And then the mystery of the relationship between Christ and his church, that Eve is paid to get her. And Adam and Eve didn't know this, that God had put them on the earth in relationship to model the relationship between Christ and the two people. Now, in the light of what Christ has done, we see this clearly. Ephesians 5:22, the husband is head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Lord. And an understanding of this relationship, of this unity, this diversity, difference, equality, that particularly for marriage is that a husband is neither a wimp nor a tyrant, but exercises loving, humble headship. And for marriage is where the wife is neither a doormat nor a usurper, but exercises joyful intelligence. Next one, next one to put our fingers to number 3. Equality and differences between men and women respect the equality and differences in authority. If we reference that 1 Corinthians 11:3, I want you to understand from the head that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is a husband, and the head of Christ is God. Headship and submission has existed eternally in God himself. And it's so crucial to understand that in the Trinity eternally. There's been headship and submission, as well as perfect equality and unity. And we have to reflect that in our relationship. Truth number 4, the equality and differences between men and women are very good. When God made the earth and made us, he said it is very good, the way he made Adam and Eve. As together, unified, that Adam to lead was very good, and it's good for us. It is mysterious, it's meant to be mysterious. This is the relationship between Christ and the church is mysterious. And it's beautiful. When it works, it's beautiful. And you see men and women working together as they should. Men leading as they should. Women serving, following as they should. All exercising their gifts as they should. Together, enjoying God, serving him together. That's beautiful. It just is. Question number 5. This is a matter of obedience to the Bible. Freedom makes the statement, egalitarians are not willing the exegetical argument. Egalitarians will dispute that, but it's worth getting read to the exegetical argument, the sum of thought that has to be turned to argue anything different than male leadership extraordinary. And this is a watershed issue because in the end we're saying, is the Bible true? It's linked to the debate on the answer, do we believe in the word of God, do we believe it's true, but are we free to twist it where it doesn't quite fit us? Truth number 6. The controversy is much bigger than you realise because it touches all of life. Touches how we think about God, touches how we think about marriage, how we think about children, how we I think it's scientific and cultural evidence. The evidence from childhood development. Now, for those of us who've got children or if you remember what it's like to have children, this is just so obvious. The different ways that boys and girls play. I have four girls, and they are bold. I've taught them to be, I want them to be adventurous, I want them to be bold, I want them to be dangerous. I don't want them to be sissy girls, I want them to have some guts. And so we've encouraged them to do things that involve a bit of danger, take risks. So the kind of women who make one day attractive, dangerous wives to bold, deadly husbands. But they play very differently, even though bold, sometimes tender as girls. They play differently from boys, because they are much more interested in creating a nasty game that involves nurturing, to get unbelievably complex in a storyline. Boys come round, all they want to do is kill them. Give me a ball, give me a stick, give me a gun, and I'm happy. They play differently. The level, when the girls sometimes say, oh no, he's coming round, because what this means is all the toys will be thrown down the stairs and reorganised. Because that's how boys do it. They're not interested in keeping things contained. It's much more aggressive, much more thorough, much more energetic, much more just manly. It's obvious. Boys are more preoccupied with the activity itself and the competitive aspect of the activity. Girls are much more interested in the storyline, the imaginative world. Boys' friendships tend to be less intimate than girls' friendships. Girls' friendships very early on become very intimate, very intense. It does lead up to a few fights and mostly highs and lows. You have to come from school, weeping and wailing. Happens all the time because of the intensity of relationships. Boys don't have that kind of intimacy. Girls all the time hugging each other. My girls arrive at school, their friends are there, they run into one another's arms if they haven't seen each other for years. Oh, it's so good to see you, it's trouble, it's good. Oh, it's so good to see you. Imagine they're in the physical intimacy. Boys get together, the only physical intimacy there is a punch. My brother and I are still like this. I'm 39, he's 37, still the way we interact physically is there. Let's just how it goes. That's sufficient. Boys' main priority seems to be to join a group based on shared activity. Once you've had a group, there is a shared priority to establish your individual rank and the dominant power after that will emerge. So, it's written by a tenured professor, Justice Murphy, and professor, it's a difference. And we can see that. I think Josh talked yesterday about how students aren't interested in hierarchy. He's right, and they don't know structured persons, actions for boys, hierarchy is hugely important. The gang form teams and guys, teams and leaders. And that emerges almost immediately. And it's different between boys and girls. Parents actually relate to kids differently. This is mistook again by this attendant professor. Because fathers are less likely than mothers to hold their infant in a face-to-face position. One tends to take the basis that there is a less exchange of emotional information by the face between fathers and infants. Mothers are more likely to follow through the child's choice of topic info, while fathers are more likely to impose their own topic. If you're a mother with a baby, the mother holds the baby like this, engaged in conversation. The father holds the baby like that. And fathers want to impose their own confession. I hate going to the playground with my kids. I find it completely boring. They propose themselves in their plan, and I think we need to organise something. The only time it goes to the playground is fun, and you organise a competition. Who can get round all the athletes quickest? And prove that the Hoser family are superior to the other families in the park. We will swing this ring higher than they do, thus demonstrating to the other parents who have these wicked boys that my girls are tougher than your boys. That's the only time it goes to the playground is fun. My wife will sit there for hours, watching the kids play, looking at my children at the moment. Next one, like a stereotype of cliche, but it seems to be demonstrably true. Women strong in empathy, men in systemizing. And let me give you this definition of what it means to be a systemizer. Systemizing is the drive to understand a system and to build one. A system is anything which is governed by rules, specifying input operation output relationships. This definition takes in systems beyond the things such as math, physics, chemistry, astronomy, logic, music, military strategy, the climate, sailing, horticulture, and computer programming. It also includes systems like libraries, economics, companies, taxonomy, board games, or sports. Men like to systemize things. We like to have categories, we like to have boxes, we like to organize, we like to see how doing A leads to B, which will result in C. And there's an interesting test. Take a bottle, an empty bottle, hold it at an angle, and ask somebody to draw the level. If there's water in it, what level, how would the water look? What is the line of the water? Now, apparently, many women will draw the line at the same angle as the bottle. But we men find funny, because as men, we know that the water will always be horizontal. It's a shocking test, but apparently that is a scientifically rigorously true test. Or it's very dense, double down. There are 170 living Nobel Prize winners. 170. How many of them are women? 10, 3. You can argue and idiotize them, so there's some fairness and some reasons to cultural reasons why that's the case. As a simple empirical fact, 3 of the current living Hamiltons in the day women. Think about the occupations that require a particular level of systemizing. Math, physics, engineering. The ratio of men to women working in those areas is the same as it was in the 1970s. And that's the ratio of 19. And again, as you say, and it is said it's a culture which is discriminating towards the mass rather than the rest. It's men, and it's a system. Groups tend to be men. And there's a biological reason for this, and this reason is testosterone. Well, testosterone leads to faster development of the right hemisphere of the brain and slower development of the left. And the lower fetal testosterone level leads to better empathizing skills. Language, communication skills, eye contact, social skills. Higher testosterone levels leads to a greater development of the right hemisphere of the brain, which leads to higher systemizing skills. And male fetuses have higher levels of testosterone than female ones do. And from 6 months old, measuring the electrical activity in the brain, a girl's left hemisphere shows more electrical activity in response to speech sounds than does a boy. Girls are just biologically hardwired to respond better at the empathetic level, speech, communication, social skills, than men who are biologically wired to respond better to systems. And that's like a problem in our world, because our world is increasingly built on one which demands empathizing skills rather than system skills. Because I think why so many men are uncomfortable in our society. They're fixed because they're not good at that stuff. Not interested in small talk, not interested in those kind of places. They're just going to get on and build a system and push A and get B out. That's what prevents the time. And what this professor in Penny says is that autism is the extreme male brain. People with autism have very poor social skills, very strong systemizing skills. And there's a much narrower gap for a boy to become autistic than there is for a girl, because the male brain is more autistic than the girl. Just how is it? And then more evidence is just a lie of a gender neutral society. Go and look at a magazine rack. We talk all the time about it's a gender neutral society, it's the opportunity for all. The marketers, the publishers know that's not true. who are the train magazines and the gun magazines and the car magazines and the city magazines and the boat magazines? Who are they written to? Men. I mean, there's a huge work of magazines for the women. And the publishers and writers know that there is this essential difference between the sexes. The lie of a gender neutral society, front against the party, Mansfield, Sisyphus, men have the highest offices, the leading reputation, they make the discoveries, complete the theories, win the prizes, start the companies, score the touchdowns. Men run things, women fail. A company imitates, elaborates, develops. This is not to say that women do not excel, but they see skills to excel as women, in accordance with the traditional stereotype of women and not the new gender neutral stereotype. It's such a dangerous state. So I think it's true. What then is the problem with men? What's our problem? There's figures about what happens when dad isn't around and increasingly well rehearsed. Children living without their fathers, the fathers are more likely to live in poverty and deprivation, more likely to have emotional and mental problems, have more trouble at school, tend to have more trouble getting along with others, have higher risk of health problems, or greater risk of suffering physical, emotional, sexual abuse, more likely to run away from home, more likely to become drug addicts, more likely to end up in prison. Now that's all well rehearsed, increasingly well rehearsed. The question, the more interesting question behind that is why the fathers go out there? Why are so many men so pathetic? That's the question behind all this evidence that keeps coming out. And I think the answer really is the infantilism of our society. That our society now is designed to keep us as children. That we are all in some way not adopted. Our consumer culture is designed to keep adults thinking and buying like children. Thinking about it, because for consumer capitalism to prevail, we must make kids consumers and make consumers kids. And some of the issues, the social issues that we talk about in the secular media as problems, are signs of a culture of immaturity and overindulgence. Obesity is talked about so much. That's a sign of immaturity and overindulgence. Consumer debt. That's okay. Immaturity. Overindulgence. Sexual promiscuity leading to all the health issues that we now have. That's immaturity. That's overindulgence. That's childlike behaviour. And we see evidence of childlike, infantile behaviour all around us. People are living with their parents much longer. And often that's because of financial issues in the current world. But real men don't stay at home with their mum until they're like 20 or 30. Just don't. We see it in people marrying later. We find immaturity. I'm going to wait and just check out my options. I'm not sure I want to. How do I know if I've got the right one? If she comes along and I find somebody else who's even better, I'm in trouble. Infantile. Having children later, I'm going to live my life. Because I'm worth it. Cosmetic surgery is happening at a younger and younger age. It finds this being infantile. Delayed gratification is a sign of adulthood. Being able to say, I will wait. I will save up, I will work hard, I will delay my gratification now in order that I can enjoy it more fully then, and it will do me greater good. And we're not good at that in our culture. We want it now, we want it instantly. We live out adolescence. We look at me now. I want it now. I have it now. Francis Farney, who writes in Leadership Journal, puts it like this. Could it be that the consumer values, both inside and outside the church, that form the uncontested foundation of our teaching, books and ministries, are fundamentally designed to promote civility and oppose maturity? And I think he's got well esteemed living across the past year in his world. Self-denial with surrendering of immediate desires is the Christian life. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer says, it simply states, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. But this invitation is noticeably absent in the gospel of consumer Christianity. So it promises joy and new life, a healthier marriage, more obedient children, a more balanced life, and less anxiety about the future. But nowhere do these promises carry the price of death. Never are we asked to deny ourselves. That is a value absolutely at odds with consumerism, the sanctity of personal desire. For people fully formed by consumerism, any God that expects personal sacrifice on the level that Jesus does cannot be seen as benevolent and certainly is not worth saving. And I think that absolutely narrows the problem of so much of Western Christianity. It's all so much about come and be happy, it's not about come and die. And actually what men really want to hear is come and die. Because all of us would rather be one of those nice men and tell me like that. We have our children and our grandchildren say, he's died, he's sacrificed himself to others. That's what we want rather than he was flabby and lazy and looking at our house and always put their demands and demand it. What's the matter about that? I bet it's quite years ago when Michael Bywater, another kind of academic, an atheist, I had a fascinating email exchanging to him after I read the book. And just the first quote, because I think it's again just nail some of the issues to us. The first one is just absolutely fantastic. It strikes you as an out of circuit, as a notice at London Paddington Station which says, please be ready to move away with your luggage when you reach the top of the escalator. Because it implies that otherwise you wouldn't be ready to move away with your luggage, but instead it's standing there like a moron, with other morons piling up against you. But eventually something has to give, and you all tunnel back down the escalator in a melee of morons, and get trapped into the mechanism and ground to hand over. And they close the blood down and scrub the gobbet of stupid flesh out of the machinery and strung up again, and the same thing would happen again, or if not, why the need for the notice? And these signs are all around us. I was standing in the fire this morning in my hotel and saw the notice at head level which said, guests are reminded to take care when standing or walking on wet surfaces. Thank you so much, Mr. Ramada Hotel. If you had not put that sign there, I would not have realised the wet surface is potentially slippery and I could fall over and break my neck and swing for the earth because I am an infantile idiot. I never before appreciated the dangers of a shower. And when I stand in my shower every morning at home, I had not realised how close to death I was until I came to a hotel. And he so kindly revealed the truth to me. I am free, I am safe. The surface is wet. I will now get a rail and a Zimmer frame, and I shall wear always my flip-flops with sticky soles into the shower in order to prevent any risk to my person that this shower might give me. And these signs are all around us, saying, you are an idiot. You are a moron. You might look like you're 40 years old or 50 years old, but actually you're only 5. And if they do not tell you what to do, and have a stupid pictogram next to the written instruction, a pictogram that didn't make any sense unless you could read the writing, if you can't do it because you're only 5 anyway, you would die. Because you are a moron. Look at the sign. Walk around Brighton today and look at the sign. The iPod. Wandering from room to room is someone with an iPod. Music no longer requires going out, being with other people, or even sitting in a room on your own listening. Now it is a current distraction, a matter of right, a way of affirming your identity without having to be identified by other members of your chosen tribe. Even when we interact with the outside world, reluctantly our ears are tied to the outside world, shuffling music into our minds. Our grandparents were taught it an appalling rudeness. After all, what do you say about, I do not acknowledge your existence. You are superfluous to me, and I am moving in the same physical space as you, but don't expect me to acknowledge it, for I am a disciple of nature and not a threat. Birth rates in the UK have been falling for years. Is this a surprise? We're so well entrenched in our infantilized self-obsession that we probably have no room for real babies, little ones, nasty little ones, with demands and requirements that can keep us and find out who we really want to be inside. We tell the story here of the subject and don't say it. When our erotic lives become ends, not means, the consequence becomes too easy irksome and we run it away. I did it myself, abandoning a 2-year-old daughter because I thought that by doing so I was fulfilling myself and being honest. And all the rest of the blabber for in a plain and adult world, I would have my face crushed. But wit in the world of big babies, when I was able to wallow in a sort of terribly smug self-pity, demanding that I would feel my pain, instead of behaving like a grown-up and not causing pain to anyone, including myself, but particularly the child for whom I was responsible. It was naturally for erotic informants. Like a teenager wriggling under the question, where were you last night? I made all sorts of excuses for myself, but in the end I was a grown man of 32, behaving like a 13-year-old. It was, of course, incredible. And what our infantile consumer culture has done is create a generation of men who are behaving in an unforgivable manner. We live in this society where we are instructed, observed, fighting all the time, you walk down Brighton High Street, reading the Boston Times, you see people's roots, monitoring your every move, we sit at computers like zombies, we're sending the ping of emails, we stare at our screens, we munch our fast food on the go, we are like babies. I'm not even talking about food, because this is big enough for me to be personal and I can handle it and it's okay. Food fabulous and is babies. Just say, I'm not going to eat that, I can't eat that, or I'm sorry, can you make me that I can't eat that? That is babyish, that is sadder than that is adolescent behavior. It's just talking, I don't like it, I don't like it, I don't want to eat like that. Adults eat what is put in front of them, thankfully, without complaint. And if they really don't like it, or really can't eat it, as adults, they simply leave it without saying anything. Because that is the adult thing to do. Not to say, oh, I don't like that, I can't eat that. And there's a theological reason this is important, it's not simply my right-wing angst. It matters submission and to Jesus. Because if you go to Africa, you will eat sheep raised and you'll be thankful for it. And if you go to Arabia, you will eat sheep eyes and you'll be grateful for them. And if you go to Mongolia, you're going to eat sheep balls and say thank you, Jesus. And to say, oh, I can't eat that, I don't like that. You've missed the gospel moment. Because you want to be with these people. You say, well, I'm sorry, I can't eat that. That's not true. That's not adult. That's childish. Right, let's let this up. These are things taken from an action article in Common Baptist Sunday Journal. First thing. Instructions of David to Solomon just as he's about to die. In David's time to die, do you know, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and whatever you say. That the Lord may establish his word and spoke concerning you, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their ways, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Moreover, you also know that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, having dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner the son of Ner and Amasa the son of Jephthah, whom he killed, avenging in time of peace the blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Act therefore according to your wisdom, but do not let his grey head go down to slur in peace. But be loyal to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadites, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for with such loyalty they met me when I said to Ashton, your brother. And there is also with you Shimei, the son of Zerah, the Benjamites, and Behurim, who cursed me with a grievous curse on the day when I went out to Mahanaim. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death for the sword. Now therefore, do not hold him guilty, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do to him. And you should bring his grey hair down his neck. To Solomon here that the covenant of a man on a throne is dependent upon obedience. Solomon, if our family is going to keep hold of this thing, we need to incline our hearts to obey the Lord. Be strong, but don't be strong just doing your own thing, be strong and obedient. Be submissive. Context of manhood. The way that Solomon is instructed by David are especially masculine. Manly. We can't imagine David giving this kind of instruction to one of his daughters. Leading, providing, protecting. Provide for those who've done well for me, kill those who've done bad for me. It's not the kind of instruction good for a daughter, it's the kind of instruction good for a son, for a man who is strong and who is obedient. The content of manhood. These are things that we can draw out of this, particularly about how those of us who are married and have children to lead in their homes, but I think also in the church, what we're actually looking for all men to do. In church and in business and in life, as men. Vision. Have a sense of this is where we're going. And certainly the husband and father should set the vision for the family. Infantile men don't do that, they actually take that to their wives. Especially spiritually, and the marriage that I look at in my church is in trouble. It's because the woman is further ahead than her husband, so we've got more vision than he has. And so it is those kids that are running around wild on the Sunday. But as teenagers, totally switched off and uninterested. And she's frustrated and he's miserable because he's got no vision. He's not leading, he's not setting the pace, he's not saying this is where we're going. So I'm asking, this is how we're going to get there. These are the things we're going to do. This means that as a family, we will pray. I will open the Bible in the morning and not leave it to my wife to do it if she feels like it. I will instruct you, I will show you how, I will model what it means to be an obedient son of God. Imitate me, watch me, learn from me. Infantile, weak men can't say that. Strong men who are obedient to God know how to inspire. They know how to stand before a group and say, isn't this great? Isn't what we're doing as a church great? That's what Terry was looking for, I'm sure, that morning when the church girl talked about. That's what I look for in the morning. I want some men to stand up and hear this say, isn't this great? God is with us. God is helping us. God is leading us. I don't have to be elders to do that. Just look at the men. To stand up and say, isn't this great? And then affirmation. Men who are able to look somebody in the eye and say, you're doing that. And say to their kids, you are a great kid. I'm so proud of you. Hey, did that with me. And then we can look one another in the eye and church and say, you're doing great. Let's move forward together. Men who are able to evaluate, we can ask the question, how are you doing? How can we improve this thing? How can we make A work better so that B flows smoother, so that C comes out more efficiently? Correction, let's make a change. It isn't working. Have the confidence to change it. Let's not be timid. And protection and provision, I'll take care of you. Often, I'll take care of you. Hear a sound downstairs in the night. It's not your wife who should go down to find out what it is. You're lying in bed pretending to be asleep still. She's over in your head. It's you who's going to go out of bed. You're going to protect your kids. If you're a father of sons, you're meant to teach your sons how to fight. And when it's right to fight, when it's right to swim a pump, and it's wrong to swim a pump. Obviously, this is a reference to help you in that. It's just like raising sons. And actually, there's a few pages in there. When it's right to fight, every dad is trying to do that. When it's right to a son to stay home. the Christ-likeness of manhood, and of course, tragically, we see this huge gulf between Christ and Solomon, that Solomon did not adhere to his father's instructions, they did not stick to obedience to the word of God, to avoid the covenant commands that how kings should behave, and rather than showing that adult restraint, to indulge in adolescent fantasy, and acquire forces and count that number and go that limit on women without them. And it comes to him in his kingdom in his career. And so simply pursuing the things of a man are not enough. As we think in the moment of the quote from Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes beginning picks up the desires of a man, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, I've had it all, I've had fields and vineyards, I've built amazing structures, I've had all the women in the world, and it's all just putting in the world. In contrast to Christ-like behavior, as an adult, which knows when to submit, but isn't as meek as a pleaser, actually in its submission is unbelievably strong. But at the cross, at that point of ultimate total humiliation, submission, weakness, that was the moment of greatest power. The world ever seen. Dropping the bomb in Hiroshima, the car unleashed, nothing compared to the car on the cross, where a man hanging naked and bleeding down. That was Solomon. Now, we cultivate manhood, these are some of the things that I've done working in my own life and encourage guys to do the hardest task first. Put it into a testament. Let's put off. I do it easy first and hopefully I never have to get to that difficult. Now, the most difficult thing, get that one out of the way, nail it, press in the name. Do that in interpersonal relationships, make the hard phone calls first. I think, particularly men, because they're not always so good at the interpersonal social skills, some people are great and say, I don't think about microphone, I've had people in the home saying how much he hates the phone. I'm like that, I don't like the phone. I do email or I do face-to-face conversation. I find it so uncomfortable. I talk to my friends, I text them, but generally, it's not my favourite medium of communication. And so, if there's some phone calls to make, I have to do that, or I'm going to make the hard one first. It's always to procrastinate, because I don't like the phone. So, you can make that interpersonal relationship, do the hard thing, run for the battle, run for it, embrace it, take that hill, big head of lake, right, give me that mountain. Do your work now as opposed to later. Don't procrastinate, work it now. Delayed gratification is better than instant gratification, because instant gratification always is cheap and thin, whereas delayed gratification is more often thick and grossly. Keep your domain in order. The creation mandate is for Adam to work the earth, to keep the domain in order. And there is an application for it. So I know we all have different working methods, and some people with perfect work say, well, actually, this is a perfectly organized filing system. I know what everything is. But from working with people like that, I think the reality is it isn't actually that efficient. And there is something godly about saying, no, I will order this. It's that in my office, and some of the young guys who work with me, I say to them, look, you've got to keep your domain order. There are all sorts of junk cards that I've been to get, but all kinds of piles of papers and books and files on your desk. That actually is not a good witness to Jesus. People come into the office, it just looks a mess. Keep your domain in order. That's a creation mandate. Kind of in the name. And kill a bear or a lion. Now it might be that you go off a gun accident and shoot a bear with your bow. It might be that you say, well, I'm going to run a marathon next year. It might be that you deal with some interpersonal conflict. But men need a friend. And we all need to find bears and lions. And I think, particularly as we get older, and now 39, I consider myself to be early middle age, and my observation is guys who go through middle age, 40, 50, and quite often have physical changes. Disappointment comes, you haven't achieved what you wanted to achieve, what you wanted to do, become cynical. What you need is a child to do. We finish with Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 12. Solomon's made all his mistakes, he's chased all his adolescent dreams, and he concludes with this. Remember your creator from the graves of your youth. Before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you say, I have no pleasure in you. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. In the day when the creatures of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are free, and those who look through the windows are dim and the doors and the streets are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of the bird and all the doors of the strong are brought low. They are afraid also what is high and curved are in the way, the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper blossoms there for long, and desire fails. Because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the street. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the city, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Yeah. That's all in conclusion. Before it's too late, grow up. Be a man. Don't get to the end. Don't get to when everything crumbles and falls to dust and you die and the mourners at the street. Don't go to a grave just having pursued adolescent patterns of behaviour. Grow up. Be a man, call yourself a man, he said. Okay.